The car smelled like death. The mother smiled through lies. And a two-year-old vanished into the Florida swamp. I'm an investigative journalist. And for over a decade, I've been chasing the truth behind America's most haunting unsolved child murder. What I found wasn't just a story. It was a system built on shadows, red tape, and a verdict that still makes the nation scream. This is not just Kaylee's story. It's ours. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Orlando, Florida. July 2008. I still remember the first time I heard the 911 call. I was working late in the newsroom when it came in. A grandmother, Cindy Anthony, panicked, breathless. Her voice cracking like a wire under pressure. It smells like there's been a dead body in the damn car. You don't forget a line like that. It digs into your gut like a hook. It was the kind of thing that makes every crime journalist in America sit up and listen. At first, no one could quite believe it. A child gone for 31 days, and no one had reported her missing? Kaylee Marie Anthony, 2 years old. Brown eyes, a beaming smile, and cheeks round with toddler joy. She hadn't been seen in a month. Not at daycare. Not with her mother. Not with anyone. And it wasn't the police who discovered it. It wasn't child services. It wasn't the neighbors. It was her grandmother, screaming through a 911 phone line, choking on the word, dead. That's when I knew something was horribly wrong. By the time I arrived in Orlando to begin my investigation, the case had already started spiraling. Local media were swarming the Anthony home like vultures over fresh kill. Protesters were planting stuffed animals on the lawn. Journalists lined the sidewalk with cameras on tripods, hoping for anything. A tear, a scream, a confession. But what we got was a smirk. Casey Anthony, Kaylee's 22-year-old mother, walked out of her home like she was auditioning for a role. Hair perfectly styled, sunglasses oversized, expression unreadable. I followed her with my recorder in hand, asking questions she refused to answer. Where was your daughter, Casey? Why didn't you report her missing? Do you understand the gravity of what's happening? Nothing. No emotion. Just the rehearsed detachment of someone who'd already decided what role to play in this unfolding crime narrative. And then the lies began to unravel. She told investigators she worked at Universal Studios. She led them there, walking with confidence through the front doors and down the hallway, until she stopped, turned, and finally confessed. I don't work here. I haven't worked here in years. It was theater. A strange, surreal performance wrapped in carefully curated deceit. She said she left Kaylee with a nanny named Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez, a woman who, as it turned out, didn't exist. The address Casey gave? An empty apartment. The number? A dead end. The trail? A ghost. None of it made sense. And yet, there it was, filed neatly in police reports, marked in evidence logs, played back in interviews. Chilling details spoken without fear. She'd been out partying too. Photos leaked to the media. Casey dancing at Fusion Nightclub. Drinking. Laughing. Wrapped around a new boyfriend. That infamous Bella Vita tattoo inked into her shoulder. Beautiful life. All while her daughter was missing. Or dead. I couldn't shake the feeling that we weren't just chasing a mother. We were chasing a shadow. Something darker, something hiding beneath a mask of normalcy. Every interview, every affidavit, every body cam recording felt like peeling back layers of rot, only to find more rot beneath. And then came the car. The white Pontiac Sunfire. The vehicle Casey had been driving while Kaylee was with the nanny. The same car that Cindy Anthony had described in her 911 call. The same car that smelled like death. When crime scene investigators opened the trunk, they gagged. Even seasoned detectives couldn't ignore what they were breathing in. The scent of decomposition. Unmistakable, foul, sickeningly sweet. A trash bag. A stained spare tire cover. A single strand of hair. Later, forensics would confirm what many already suspected. The chemical compounds found in the air inside that trunk matched those produced by a decomposing human body. The hair. Consistent with Kaylee's. Complete with post-mortem root banding. It was becoming clear we were no longer looking for a missing child. We were investigating a murder. But what haunted me wasn't just the evidence. It was the silence. Casey never cried, never begged for help, never once, not in a single recorded conversation, asked, "Where is my daughter?" Instead, she asked for a pen, to write a list of what she needed from the commissary. That was the moment I knew this story wasn't just tragic. It was terrifying, because it didn't feel like the actions of a grieving mother. It felt like the rehearsed detachment of a hidden killer. The kind of detachment you only see when justice tales become twisted beyond recognition. When emotion is replaced with calculation. When a smile becomes a weapon. And yet, this was only the beginning. Chapter 1 was the moment the story cracked open. Chapter 2 was when it exploded. I've covered financial corruption, murder tales, even chilling accounts that never made it past local headlines. But I'd never seen anything like the media wildfire surrounding Casey Anthony. She wasn't just a suspect. She was becoming a spectacle. Every frame of her face, blown up on TV screens. Every smirk, every flip of her hair, every whispered word from jail. Dissected like forensic evidence. It wasn't just the crime scene that was being analyzed. It was her. And the cameras couldn't look away. She was dubbed Tot Mom by Nancy Grace. A name that became its own brand of indictment. Across every major network, CNN, Fox, CNN, you'd see the toddler's smiling face beside photos of her mother in club dresses, raising shot glasses, caught in the swirl of strobe lights and smoke machines. It made the public sick, but it made the story viral. America wasn't just watching a case unfold. They were devouring it. A carefully curated tale of the party girl mom who couldn't keep her lies straight and seemed to care more about her next tequila shot than her missing child. What the headlines didn't always show was the chaos behind them. I was embedded in Orlando now, living in a cheap motel off Colonial Drive. Every morning, I'd pass reporters chain-smoking outside the courthouse. Every evening, I'd dodge protesters outside the Anthony home, screaming, "Murderer!" and planting new stuffed animals and crosses on the lawn like tombstones. Someone threw a brick at her father's car. Another tried to punch her brother. This wasn't just journalism anymore. This was war. But war over what? Casey Anthony hadn't been charged with murder. Not yet. At that point, it was obstruction, lying to investigators, interference. The big charges were still being assembled by prosecutors behind closed doors. And meanwhile, something strange was happening. Casey, despite everything, was calm. In jailhouse calls, she laughed. She giggled with her parents. She flirted with guards. She asked about the media coverage with thinly veiled curiosity, almost like she was watching a movie about someone else. "Everyone's acting like I'm running around murdering babies. That's not me." I wrote those words down in my notebook and circled them 3 times. "Not me." It was the kind of denial you don't just say. You need to say it over and over again because you're terrified someone might actually believe the opposite. She lied about where she worked. She lied about who had Kaylee. She lied about her daily routine. The lies weren't even smart. They were lazy, sloppy, unsettling. And yet she stuck to them with the kind of conviction that makes you wonder if she believed them herself. This wasn't just a woman hiding something. This was someone performing a role in her own personal courtroom drama. And we, the press, were her unwilling stage crew. I remember the day her Bella Vita tattoo photo leaked. A Latina tattoo artist described how Casey had walked in mid-July, asking for something bold. Something that meant freedom. She chose beautiful life. In the days after her daughter's disappearance, it hit me like a gut punch. There are mistakes. And then there are statements. That ink felt like the latter. Chilling secrets don't always come in evidence bags. Sometimes they're etched in skin. What we didn't know, not yet, was that the prosecution was watching all of this just as closely as the media. They weren't just building a case file. They were crafting a story to combat hers. And somewhere inside that narrative was something far more dangerous than any lie Casey Anthony had told. A digital footprint. Computer records would soon show searches from the Anthony home for how to make chloroform, neck-breaking, and missing children sites. Casey said she didn't make those searches. She blamed her parents. The same parents she'd later accuse of hiding a body. Of covering up Kaylee's death. Her lies were stacking like bodies in a morgue, cold, unsettling, unclaimed. But there was one thing she couldn't deny. The child was gone. The scent in the car was real. And somewhere near that family home, Kaylee Marie Anthony had vanished. Either by accident or by design. I was writing my notes late one night in the motel lobby when a court clerk I'd been speaking to whispered something that sent a chill down my spine. They found something. A bag. Out in the woods near Suburban Drive. That was it. The circus was about to find its grave. There are moments in an investigation when the silence gets heavier than the noise. This was one of them. December 11, 2008. I was standing in a crowded hallway inside the Orange County Sheriff's Office when the radio chatter changed. A utility worker had called in a tip. Something about a trash bag. Bones. Off Suburban Drive, just a half mile from the Anthony home. I remember the detective's voice going cold. We've got skeletal remains. Small. Child-sized. I dropped my notepad. That was the moment Kaylee Anthony stopped being a headline and became a corpse. The wooded area was already sealed by the time I arrived. Yellow crime scene tape stretched across the trees like a noose. Reporters lined up behind it, silent for once, staring at the clearing. A baby blanket. Plastic bag. A tiny skull. I locked eyes with one of the forensics techs as she carried out the evidence bags. Her gloves were soaked with swamp water and soil. She looked like she hadn't blinked in hours. She wouldn't say a word. Because what was there to say? We had spent months searching for a missing girl. And there she was, discarded like garbage. The forensic reports came in slowly, piece by piece, like a puzzle made from human tragedy. The bones had been exposed to the elements. Animals had scattered some of the remains. The skull still had duct tape stuck across the mouth, wrapped around the jawline, clinging to her baby hair. I remember writing in my journal that night. There's a story in this tape. A message left behind. It wasn't an accident. That much was clear. Back at the lab, analysts examined everything, from the trash bag fibers to the root growth around the bones. The body had likely been there for months, buried beneath Florida heat and storms, decomposing in silence while the nation debated whether her mother was misunderstood or a monster. And then came the trunk. The Pontiac Sunfire Kaylee Anthony had driven. I gained access to the forensics breakdown from the lab technician who handled the air sampling. He walked me through the results like he was reading a confession out loud. The interior reeked of human decomposition. Tests confirmed the presence of volatile organic compounds consistent with a decaying human body. Not an animal. Not trash. A body. Then the carpet stain, tested and marked as biological. A hair recovered from the trunk showed signs of postmortem root banding, a phenomenon that only occurs after death. This wasn't tabloid hysteria anymore. It was crime scene investigation. Science doesn't lie, but people do. And that's where Kaylee Anthony's defense began to take shape, in the gaps between evidence and belief. She claimed she didn't know where Kaylee was. Claimed she'd left her with the mysterious Zenaida. Claimed she'd lied because she was scared. But the forensics didn't care about her fear. They told a different story. Computer searches from the family home showed someone had Googled how to make chloroform. Another search, neck-breaking. Another, household weapons. Kaylee said she didn't make those searches. Then she said maybe her father did. Then she changed the story again. Her lies weren't just confusing. They were shifting sand beneath a crumbling foundation. I interviewed one of the crime lab analysts after hours. She asked me not to record, just to listen. We have more evidence than most child homicide cases ever get. But it might not be enough. I didn't understand. The problem, she said, is that none of it tells you how she died. And that was the paradox of the Kaylee Anthony case. Overwhelming evidence but no official cause of death. Just duct tape, bones, a bag. No fingerprints. No confession. No witness. Just the question that hung in every courtroom hallway, in every newsroom headline, in every true crime fan's obsession. If she didn't do it, then who did? And if no one did it, then why is a baby buried in the woods? The next morning, the prosecution filed for first-degree murder. Kaylee Anthony would be tried for the death of her daughter. And I would sit in that courtroom every day with one mission, to watch what happens when forensics meet fabrication. Because in this case, the science was speaking clearly. It was the people who couldn't stop lying. Suburban Drive. A name that used to mean nothing to most Floridians. Just a short, forgettable street tucked behind suburban sprawl in Orlando. But now, it's become sacred ground to some. A place of mourning. A crime scene. A graveyard. I stood behind the police line, staring into the tree line where Kaylee's tiny remains had been found. The image plays on a loop in my mind, a black garbage bag torn open by time and animals. Is it bones? A skull. A baby blanket with cartoon characters faded by rain. And duct tape. Duct tape over the mouth of a child. It doesn't get more brutal than that. Even the toughest crime scene investigators on site went silent when the discovery was confirmed. One of them, a father of three, walked off into the woods and threw up. Another had to be physically helped away when he began sobbing. Because we weren't just looking at evidence. We were looking at the erasure of a life. I followed the details obsessively, not just because I'm a journalist, but because something inside me had shifted. Kaylee was gone, yes. But what killed me was that she was discarded. Hidden like trash. Left to rot just minutes from her own home. She wasn't lost. She was dumped. And the person who knew that better than anyone was her mother. Casey Anthony stayed behind bars as the forensic team processed the site. And every revelation added more weight to the growing mountain of suspicion. The trash bag was identical to ones found in the Anthony household. So was the duct tape. So was the laundry bag used to wrap Kaylee's bones. It was like a puzzle, and all the pieces came from the same kitchen drawer. I sat down with one of the crime scene techs for an off-the-record conversation. Her eyes were red-rimmed from exhaustion, but her voice was steady. There's no chance this was an accident. You don't wrap an accident in plastic, tape its mouth, and throw it in the swamp. The media ran with it. Protesters outside the courthouse began chanting, "Justice for Kaylee," every morning. The home on Hope Spring Drive became a war zone of teddy bears, crosses, and outrage. And then came the autopsy report. It was inconclusive. No cause of death. The remains were too decomposed. No soft tissue left to examine. No internal injuries to find. Just bones. Bones in the woods. That became the opening for the defense. They pounced. No cause of death, they argued. No direct link between Casey and the dumping site. No DNA on the duct tape. Reasonable doubt. It was as if science had spoken too quietly, and the courtroom refused to lean in. Meanwhile, prosecutors painted their own picture. This was a mother who didn't want to be a mother anymore. A woman who wanted freedom. To party. To live that bella vita. So she made Kaylee disappear. They called it a murder narrative with no confession. Just intention. I watched every moment from the gallery, scribbling down notes while trying to make sense of a case built on unraveling secrets and sharp minds playing emotional chess. Casey's team told a very different story. Kaylee had drowned in the family pool. George Anthony, her father, had found the body. He panicked. He helped Casey cover it up. It was a thrilling narrative, sure. But not a single shred of forensic evidence supported it. Not one photograph. Not one neighbor. Not one document. Just a story. Carefully curated, deliberately planted, and devastatingly persuasive. The courtroom audience was split. Some cried for Kaylee. Some side-eyed the prosecution. But what haunted me, what kept me up at night, was the question I wrote in my journal again and again. Kaylee drowned, why the tape? Why the bag? Why the lies? I knew why. Because this wasn't about drowning. It was about disposal. Disposing of a life. A responsibility. Future. And by the time we got to the trial, the question wasn't whether Kaylee had died. It was whether anyone in that courtroom had the courage to say what needed to be said out loud. That Casey Anthony didn't just fail her daughter. She erased her. And in doing so, she wrote herself into the twisted legacy of America's most sinister cases, where the hidden killers don't always come with a weapon in hand. Sometimes they come with a smile. I arrived at the courthouse at 4:12 a.m., not because I had to, but as I needed to. By sunrise, the line stretched around the block. Reporters, protesters, spectators, even tourists. Some were clutching signs. Others carried coffee in sleeping bags. And every single one of them was hungry for the same thing. The goof. Or something that looked like it. This wasn't just a trial anymore. It was America's most publicized reckoning. The kind of spectacle that happens when grief meets rage and justice drowns in noise. Inside courtroom 23, I watched Casey Anthony walk in. Hair sleek. Shirt tucked. Emotionless. Like always. She sat between her defense attorneys, Jose Baez and Chaney Mason, hands folded neatly, a slight twitch at the corner of her mouth. Some days it was a smirk. Others it was fear. But never once, not once, did she look like a mother mourning her child. The prosecution began with fire. Jeff Ashton stood tall before the jury and delivered an opening that sliced through the morning silence. Kaylee Anthony didn't die by accident. She died because her mother decided she was in the way. The room froze. The words hung in the air like smoke. Acrid, heavy, impossible to ignore. He called it premeditated murder, masked by deception, driven by selfishness. Casey had wanted her freedom. No more diapers. No more babysitters. No more toddler. She googled chloroform. She researched neck breaking. She dumped her daughter's body like garbage and went out dancing the same night. Then he played the tapes. Jailhouse recordings. Phone calls. Police interrogations. Casey lying with a calm voice, even when confronted. Casey laughing on the phone with her parents. Casey asking, "Can someone get me a hoodie? It's freezing in here." Meanwhile, Kaylee was already dead. The prosecution's evidence was overwhelming, not just chilling details, but chilling patterns. Air samples from the trunk confirmed decomposition. Hair with postmortem banding. Trash bags and laundry bags matching the Anthony home. Duct tape found across Kaylee's skull. A computer search history filled with horror. Everything pointed to one thing. Kaylee didn't just die. She was erased. But then the defense stood. And everything turned sideways. Jose Baez stepped forward, adjusted his tie, and delivered one of the most unexpected openings I've ever heard in a courtroom. Kaylee Anthony was never murdered. She drowned. In the family pool. George Anthony found her. Panicked. Covered it up. And Casey? She kept lying, because she was raised to lie. Gasps. Audible gasps from the gallery. One woman fainted. Baez alleged that George Anthony had molested Casey as a child. That she was conditioned to bury secrets. That she lived in fear and shame. And that her daughter's accidental death triggered a collapse of all those buried traumas. The courtroom became a battlefield of storytelling secrets. Suddenly, it wasn't about science anymore. It was about psychology. Memory. Generational abuse. The gray space where truth becomes slippery. Baez made Casey a victim. And to summon the jury, it worked. I sat through every day of testimony. Some moments burned into me permanently, like the forensic anthropologist showing images of Kaylee's remains and whispering, "This is all that's left." Or when Cindy Anthony, Casey's own mother, wept on the stand, trying to defend her daughter while unraveling under cross-examination. Or when George Anthony was asked if he had ever molested Casey. His voice broke. He looked away. He denied it. But the seed was planted. That's how you dismantle a murder case. You don't attack the evidence. You attack the story behind it. You replace it with another. Equally dramatic, equally emotional, but one that can't be disproven. Baez didn't have to convince the jury that Casey was innocent. He just had to convince them there was another possibility. And possibility in a courtroom is powerful. As the trial wore on, the mood outside grew darker. Protesters screamed through bullhorns. One woman tried to rush the courthouse with a Kaylee poster strapped to her chest. Police tackled her before she reached the steps. Inside, tension was everywhere. The shadows of justice grew longer. And I knew deep down that this story wasn't headed toward closure. It was headed toward something far more painful. A verdict. One way or another. The story would end soon. But the question lingered like a splinter in every reporter's mind, in every juror's hesitation, in every parent's heart. Could a mother really do this and walk free? I can still hear the words. In the case of the state of Florida versus Casey Marie Anthony, we, the jury, find the defendant not guilty. The silence that followed wasn't silence at all. It was a collective, invisible scream, a rupture in logic, in justice, in grief. I was there. Row 3 of the press gallery, pen in hand, writing through my own disbelief. Not guilty of first-degree murder. Not guilty of aggravated manslaughter. Not guilty of aggravated child abuse. Only guilty of lying to police. 4 counts. That was it. Casey Anthony would not be held accountable for Kaylee's death. The air left the courtroom like a sucked lung. People stared at each other, stunned. The prosecution sat frozen. Jeff Ashton's jaw clenched. Linda Drane Burdick blinked once, then buried her face in a folder. Outside, all hell broke loose. The crowd, hundreds deep, erupted into cries and fury. reporters shouted into their cameras. Protesters threw water bottles at the courthouse steps. A man beat his fists against a palm tree and sobbed. And Casey? She smiled. A small, flickering, almost imperceptible smile, like she'd just won a game no one knew she was playing. That smile haunts me. Not because it confirmed guilt, but because it radiated something colder. Relief without remorse. As she walked out of the courtroom, flanked by guards, her attorneys shielding her from cameras, a woman behind me whispered, "She got away with it." Maybe she did. Because here's the truth. The courtroom is not where justice lives. It's where the law is argued. And the law requires certainty. Beyond a reasonable doubt. A phrase that feels like a shield until it becomes a wall. The jury later said they didn't believe Casey was innocent. They just couldn't prove she was guilty. No cause of death. No direct witness. No smoking gun. Just a trail of lies, a trunk full of decomposition, and a child thrown into the woods like a piece of broken furniture. The system, built on evidence, logic, and rules, collapsed under its own weight. Red tape. Bureaucracy. Doubt dressed up as mercy. That night, I went back to my hotel, closed the blinds, and stared at my notes for hours. Lines scribbled with urgency weeks before now looked hollow. Duct tape. Baby blanket. Smiling mother in nightclub. Every detail had screamed guilt, and none of it had mattered. I called one of my sources, a crime scene investigator who'd worked the woods off Suburban Drive. He answered on the first ring. "Tell me it's a mistake," I said. There was a long pause. "No mistake," he replied. "Just the system doing what it does." I asked him how he was coping. He didn't answer. Just hung up. In the following days, Casey Anthony went into hiding. Death threats poured in. Protesters camped outside her attorney's home. Talk shows exploded with rage. Nancy Grace's voice cracked as she shouted into the camera, "The devil is dancing tonight." But what struck me most wasn't the anger. It was the sadness. A nation had watched a little girl disappear. Watched her bones pulled from the woods. Watched the trial unfold like a murder mystery we already knew the ending to. And still, nothing. No accountability. No admission. No justice. Just silence. And a smile. Kaylee Marie Anthony was buried a second time that day, not beneath dirt, but beneath a verdict. I flew home a week later, my suitcase heavier than when I arrived. Not because of clothes or notes, but because I'd seen something up close that I couldn't unsee. I'd watched the American justice system blink, and when it opened its eyes again, the killer had walked away. I used to believe trials were where the truth came to breathe. But after the Casey Anthony verdict, I started to understand something darker. Sometimes trials aren't about the truth at all. Sometimes they're about what never gets said. About the secrets that get buried alive. In the weeks following the acquittal, I went back through every lead, every discarded thread that never made it to the courtroom floor. There were so many, interviews sealed, evidence dismissed, people who claimed they knew things but were never called to testify. And one of them, a name I won't share here, changed everything. She was a former inmate at the Orange County Jail. She and Casey had been housed near each other during the pretrial phase. They exchanged whispers through walls, shared glances in the rec yard. It wasn't friendship, more like curiosity. One night, she claimed Casey told her something. "They'll never prove it. No body, no crime. Not if it's done right." I remember how quiet the woman's voice was when she repeated those words to me. No drama. Just dread. I asked if she'd told the prosecution. He said yes. They logged the statement but never called her. Too risky. Too subjective. Too easily dismissed by the defense. Another piece of the puzzle. Left out of the picture. And that was the theme over and over again. Evidence that wasn't evidence. Truth that wasn't truth, at least not in legal terms. The Anthony home computer showed those infamous searches. Chloroform, neck-breaking, how to make homemade weapons. But when pressed, Casey's mother Cindy testified that she may have been the one who typed those queries. The courtroom was left to choose between two options. A grieving grandmother who Googled chloroform by accident while researching chlorophyll for her dying dog. Or a daughter who used her mother's computer to plan a murder. And somehow neither version felt believable. I started collecting these contradictions. I called them the missing testimonies. The stories that were too uncomfortable, too complicated, or too inconvenient to let in. George Anthony, the father, the accused, the alleged co-conspirator in the drowning story, had been vilified by Casey's defense. And yet, when I met with him one afternoon outside a hardware store in East Orlando, he looked like a man trying to hold on to the edge of a cliff. He was thinner, paler. His hands shook as he lit a cigarette. He didn't say much, until I asked him the one question that had stalked him since day one. Did you help your daughter cover up Kaylee's death? His eyes welled up immediately. I wanted to believe it was an accident, he said. I did. I prayed for it. But every time I try to believe that, I see that bag. That baby. That tape. That swamp. He exhaled long and slow. You don't hide an accident like that. That line stayed with me. You don't hide an accident like that. You only hide intention. Shame. Guilt. Or worse, satisfaction. And if George was hiding something, he was hiding it inside grief so thick I couldn't touch it. Later that month, I returned to Suburban Drive. The crime scene had been cleared. But the site was still sacred. People left stuffed animals, crosses, wind chimes. One woman brought flowers every week like clockwork. She told me she had a daughter the same age as Kaylee. I never met her, she said, staring into the brush. But I can feel her. I stood there a long time, listening, remembering. Remembering the stories we weren't allowed to tell. The motives we weren't allowed to prove. The secrets too warped to survive cross-examination. Casey Anthony walked free. But the truth never did. It stayed locked inside journal pages. Inside tear-streaked interviews. Inside the four walls of a home that once held a child with brown eyes and a future. This wasn't just a story of what happened. It was a story of what was silenced. And I couldn't let it stay that way. Because buried secrets have a way of crawling back to the surface. Especially the ones that were never supposed to be found. It had been months since the trial ended, but I couldn't let it go. Not because of what was said, but because of what wasn't. I returned to the place where Kaylee's remains were found. Suburban Drive. The swampy patch of woods behind the Anthony home. A place that once held silence and now held memory. The kind of memory that sticks to your shoes like the Florida mud. I wasn't the only one who had come back. Someone had left a new teddy bear tied to the tree line, its fur matted from rain. A laminated photo of Kaylee was tucked into a wreath, her eyes bright, still smiling. Wind chimes clinked softly in the heat, like whispers, faint and eerie. This wasn't just a crime scene anymore. It was a monument to loss. And yet no plaque marked it. No sign. Just a clearing. Just the knowing. I stood there, notebook in hand, staring into the trees. I imagined Kaylee playing in that same yard, just yards from the spot where she was discarded. The contrast was unbearable. The echo of innocence next to the reality of death. A neighbor approached me quietly. An older woman. She lived three doors down. She'd watched the media circus, the trial, the aftermath. You know what no one ever talks about? She asked. The fact that she was right there. That whole time. Right there. And they kept pretending she was just missing. That silence, that hollow space between what we knew and what we admitted, was louder than any courtroom transcript. Back at my motel, I dug into the old photos again. The aerial shots. The crime scene diagrams. The heat maps. The cadaver dog footage. Each piece of evidence lined up like a trail of breadcrumbs that had led us to a dead child and a living suspect. But justice had turned its head. As I scribbled in my notebook, I found myself writing a line I didn't expect. Sometimes the killer isn't the person who does the most harm. It's the system that pretends not to notice. The state had failed Kaylee. The media had fed on her. And Casey had walked away with a clean slate, or at least a legal one. She'd filed bankruptcy, vanished into the shadows. Rumors swirled about her changing names, dating photographers, even starting her own investigation business. America had moved on. But I hadn't. Because beneath the headlines, beneath the documentaries and hashtags and tabloid updates, something more dangerous had happened. We had normalized the erasure of a child. The public outrage had faded. The teddy bears were fading too. And with every news cycle that passed, Kaylee's voice drifted further into static. But the swamp didn't forget. The trees still stood. The ground still held the echo of her final breath. The bugs. The roots. The heat. The goof. And then, something happened. As I turned to leave that day, a woman, maybe in her 60s, stopped me at the trailhead. She had tears in her eyes, a candle in one hand and a folded letter in the other. She placed the letter at the foot of a small memorial cross and looked at me. I wrote her every year since it happened. Same message. I asked what it said. I'm sorry the world failed you. And just like that, I couldn't breathe. Because that's what it was. All of it. A failure. A brutal, haunting, permanent failure. No system should allow a child to vanish. Not once, not twice, and call that justice. And yet here we were. The swamp still held her bones. The court still held its secrets. And the mother who laughed and danced while her daughter decomposed now held her freedom. Echoes don't lie. They only wait for someone to listen. And I was still listening. Casey Anthony disappeared after the verdict. Not legally, but spiritually. She became a ghost in plain sight. I tracked her through whispers. False sightings in South Florida. A blurry photo outside a gas station in West Palm. Rumors of a plastic surgery consult. A short-lived documentary appearance that vanished just as quickly as it surfaced. She had freedom, but no peace. And yet, she wasn't the one who paid the highest price. That belonged to Kaylee. Always Kaylee. A child who never got to grow up. Never got a second birthday party. Never got to go to kindergarten. Never got justice. What does freedom mean when it's bought with silence? What is it worth when the truth is never spoken, only sidestepped? After the trial, Casey's legal team went on a victory lap. Interviews, talk shows, book deals were floated and buried. But for the Anthony family, there were no celebrations. Only ruins. George and Cindy Anthony's marriage unraveled on national TV. George attempted suicide just months after the verdict. A failed attempt to escape a guilt he never admitted but always wore on his face. Cindy defended her daughter until the weight of contradiction collapsed around her. I interviewed a former friend of Casey's who'd reconnected with her briefly after the trial. She wouldn't give her name, but she told me this. Casey never talks about Kaylee. Not really. He talks about the media. The trial. The betrayal. But not the baby. Not the baby. The one who mattered most had become the one mentioned least. Because in this version of freedom, the victim doesn't get a voice. She becomes a shadow. A name carved on a grave. A flash in a montage. A statistic. Meanwhile, Casey talked about rebuilding. About dating again. About becoming a private investigator. The irony made me sick. A woman who lied to detectives, destroyed evidence, and walked out of jail smiling. Now offering her services to help solve crimes? It was almost comical. Almost. Until I remembered the little skull in the woods. The duct tape. The blanket. The bag. Then it just made me furious. One night, I sat down with a criminal psychologist who'd followed the trial closely. She'd consulted on similar cases. Children killed by parents. Accidental deaths turned cover-ups. Emotionally detached defendants. I asked her plainly, "Do you think Casey Anthony killed her daughter?" He didn't hesitate. "Absolutely. But not the way people think. I think she let her die. I think she watched it happen. Maybe not even intentionally. And then she decided her freedom was more important than the truth. Freedom over truth. That was the trade. That was the price. And the justice system, bound by red tape, battered by media frenzy, confused by conflicting stories, paid it. In full. The truth is, Casey didn't win. Not really. She can't walk down a street without a whisper. Can't apply for a job without a background check screaming her name. Can't post a photo without someone writing murderer in the comments. But that's not justice. That's a substitute for justice. A placeholder. Kaylee's voice didn't get to echo through a courtroom. She didn't get a witness stand. A chance to testify. A defense. And so we, the reporters, the public, the prosecutors, the protesters, became her voice. We shouted until we were hoarse. Cried until we were numb. And when it was over, we were left with nothing but unsettling narratives and chilling silence. There are people who will tell you this case ended in 2011 with the verdict. They're wrong. It never ended. It just stopped being televised. Because when a story this broken passes through the justice system and walks away unscathed, it doesn't die. It mutates. It infects everything after it. Every child case. Every missing person. Every parent who claims innocence when guilt is whispering behind their smile. And I think that's what scares me most. Not that Casey Anthony was found not guilty, but that the system told us, loud and clear, that the truth alone isn't enough. Kaylee Anthony vanished twice. Once from the world and once from the story. The first time was physical. Tangible. A two-year-old girl, full of life and laughter, disappeared. Her tiny voice silenced. Her body discarded like waste in the woods behind her home. But the second time, that happened in court. That was the day a jury, bound by the limits of procedure and shadowed by red tape and bureaucracy, erased her from the narrative. Replaced her with doubt. With theory. With technicalities. And in doing so, they let her mother walk free. I sat in my apartment for hours after the final broadcast aired, staring at the folders stacked around me. Pages of notes. Photos. Autopsy reports. Crime scene maps. Handwritten letters from viewers, some too emotional to read out loud. I kept coming back to one question. How do you tell a child's story when no one is willing to hear it? The answer, I've realized, is you don't tell it all at once. You tell it again. And again. And again. Until someone listens. Because Kaylee's case didn't just haunt the nation. It redefined the true crime genre. It blurred the line between entertainment and justice. Between storytelling and investigation. Between the sharp mind of a killer and the blindfolded eyes of a system afraid to call things by their real names. We heard screams from the basement. Metaphorically and literally. We watched secrets fester behind a picket fence. We watched a mother celebrate her freedom while the world lit candles for the daughter she never spoke of. And through it all, we forgot the one person who never got to speak. Kaylee Marie Anthony. A little girl with brown eyes and bounce in her step. She became a headline. Hashtag. A ghost. And now, a legacy. I returned to her grave one last time. There were fewer toys this visit. The media had long since moved on. But someone had left a new note, tucked beneath a butterfly figurine. Read. You were loved. Even by strangers. I stood there for a long time. No questions left to ask. No verdict left to await. Just wind and leaves and silence. Kaylee was gone. Not just from the world. But from her own story. Drowned in defense strategies. Hidden behind courtroom tactics. Buried under a pile of gripping tales and murder narratives that favored spectacle over justice. But not here. Not in this podcast. Not in this voice. Here she lives. In the truth. In the echoes of a story that refuses to be silenced. In the carefully documented failures of a system that called it closure and walked away. Because this was never just a case. It was a mirror. And we've all been looking into it ever since.